If you don't like capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want?
And there is a great deal of new construction of new institutions, new forms, new cooperatives, new worker-owned companies that's happening all over the country.
This is the Gar Alperovitz Podcast, a regular look at the ideas of historian and political economist Gar Alperovitz as he explores strategies to democratize wealth and empower workers and communities.
The subject really that we're going to talk about is deadly serious, and I approach it from that point of view. And one way to give you an introduction to it is to just remind you of some of the numbers that are now commonly known by economists, but we tend to forget. The top 1% of Americans now each year garners for itself, I don't use the word earns, garners for itself more income than the bottom 120 million Americans taken together. The top 1% of wealth holders, owners of productive wealth, have just about half of all of the productive wealth of the nation. The top 5% have 70% of the productive wealth of the nation. Those are medieval numbers. I don't mean that in an abstract or rhetorical sense. That's the way a medieval society is structured. And we tend to forget that it is this concentrated and that is in fact the society we live in. Furthermore, it's getting worse, of course. Only 20 years ago, the top 1% had about 10% of the income. Now, by various measures, they have about 20% of the income. Typically, the top CEO at one point had 40 or 45 times the earnings of the bottom worker. Now it's, by various estimates, 350 or 450, and some years 500 times the bottom person, way out of line and getting worse. So one needs to stop to think about that, and at the same time recall that 37 million Americans live in poverty, and a third of all black children are brought up in poverty, a third still today. So that is the society we live in, but one way to get a further, I'm not going to give you too many quotes on this, but one way to get a further picture of just what it's all about is that two recent studies, one by the OECD, that's the Organization of European, mainly European and Advanced Industrial Countries. Of its 30 members, the United States ranks the largest gap between its wealthiest and poorest households after Mexico and Turkey. We are at the bottom. A recent UN report, slightly different measurement techniques, the United States ties with Turkmenistan and Ghana for having the 74th worst unequal distribution of income in the world. So that's what we're talking about. And the bottom line question really is, and what this book addresses is, do the people at the top deserve what they have? Or is there a broader understanding that might convey a different way of thinking about and framing the discussion? And we're trying to penetrate in this book, and I think this is necessary for both the academic and the political debate, to a much deeper level of understanding than goes by the Joe the Plumber debate on one hand, or we ought to do well by the poor on the other. We're trying to get not just to framing, which is a language some people know about these days, but to profound philosophical frameworks, and that's what the book's about. So let me give you one way to begin to think about it. Most of us were taught in economics class that wealth is produced by the three factors of production, land, labor, and capital, traditionally. And individual effort counts in all three. One of the things we've learned in the last 35 to 40 years, and dating back to studies in the 1950s by some Nobel Prize-winning economists, is that that isn't true. And in fact, it's profoundly wrong. So let me tell you what I mean by that. Imagine yourself in the year 1800 in the United States, and take a person then of equal talent to a person today. Make them equal in all respects, make them work just as hard as each other, make them be just as intelligent, okay? They're all equal in every respect, and indeed they have the same amount of education, number of hours, obviously not content. Now today's person will produce roughly 30 times as much, depending upon what measure you use, as that person in 1800. Obviously, it's very simple. Technology has changed. But note carefully, this person has done nothing whatsoever to deserve the huge technological gift that is a social construction by generation after generation after generation of people who've created all the technologies, the arithmetic, the calculus, the metallurgy, the chemistry, all the knowledge that goes into the change between now and then. Very simple point, very profound if you grab the edge of it. It means that effort, what you do, how hard you work, does matter. But compared with the vast inheritance of the past, particularly of knowledge, and the current estimates are 90% of current production, 90%, has nothing to do with what anything that anybody does today. It has to do with the application of the received gift of knowledge over time. Now, in one sense, that's very obvious. In another sense, if you think about it in a different way, who owns that 90%? Who should own the 90%? Who should own that which comes to us all from that which was created in the past? That's what this book's about. That's what we call it, our common inheritance. Now, Bill Gates would say, in his 50 or 60 billion, depending where the stock market is, or $40 billion, he deserves what he's got because he did something great. Most of what Bill Gates did, most of what he did, built on a vast, vast history of development until he dropped one small pebble, and I think it was an important pebble, on top of a Gibraltar that he got from a common and collective inheritance of knowledge. So the question to him is, who owns all that knowledge? Should he get it? Should he get all of it? Or should he get something for what he did? And how do you measure that? So let me give you another way to think about that very simple question. Point yourself out 100 years into the future and consider a woman born then in which the income she will have will be approximately 7 times, that's the rate of development at current rates, if you project what happened in the 20th century 100 years forward, she'll have 7 times the income you will have. Almost all of it will come from the technological gift that will occur before she's born. Does she deserve, and in what sense does she deserve, that income way out there? Is it her moral right to all of that? Or has the society created the knowledge, which is the technological basis of what she then can add something small to? So that's another way to get at this book. People find an easier way to think about it, and they think about the simple edge of the argument is this. The government provides money for many inventions, computers, technology of various kinds. I've got a long, long list, many of you have read it, and it's in the book as well, in which the computer itself is highly financed, the internet is financed, this is all publicly given. That ought to be, since it's created by the public, many people feel, the public deserves to be recompensed for the investment the public made. That's the simple end of the argument. Most people see that right away. This argument goes deeper to ask, what do we do about the collective inheritance that society creates over many generations that is the basis of all wealth? And the argument is that, in some profound sense, that is something we all deserve to benefit from collectively, as a society and as a community. So that's one of the ways to think about it. Another is to think about the inheritance not only of knowledge, but of all the institutions which create the transfer of knowledge over time. The one that's most obvious is the university. But the creation of networks, publications, scientific journals, various forms of transmitting knowledge, without which none of us could have the knowledge to build the computer. All of that is a collective inheritance. Take away the university system, or take away the journals that were created, and Bill Gates is about in the same place that a man was in 1800. Or if you think about Newton, without the prehistory of all the work that was done before he got there, would be able to do something slightly better than a very intelligent caveman. Because what he's really building on is the knowledge and the creation over time. So that's what we're pointing to. Who deserves that part of production? We definitely believe in incentives. Some part of production is, in fact, due to what people do, creative work, effort, all of that counts. But it is rather small, marginal compared with this large inheritance. So that's another way to get at the same set of arguments. There are different ways in which you can go. I want to give you a couple different ways of thinking about this that go beyond that. There is the if you look at the argument that was made by the plumber, Joe the plumber, he says, I deserve whatever I create. Bill Gates Sr. gets at the same argument in a different way. He says, go out and live on a desert island in the middle of the ocean. Tell me, Joe, how much can you produce if you live out there? Very little, obviously, because he doesn't have the vast benefits of living in a society which has all of these huge gifts from the past. The other person who you find on this is Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett says just about the same thing. He says, if I were born in Bangladesh, I could not have done what I've done. If I were born in 1700 rather than 1800, I could have achieved very little. They also are pointing to this central question of who deserves that which comes to us all collectively. Now, this argument has been broadly raised in, over time, a sporadic interest in it over different ways of talking about it over time. Have looked at social inheritance. The British liberal school in the late 19th century and the early part of the 20th century developed theses along this line. Even Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Theodore Roosevelt talked in a broad way about societies ought to benefit from what society creates. But where the breakthrough is, and why we think there's a chance of altering the discussion if we can push this forward into the public political arena, the breakthrough is in the Nobel Prize-winning studies lately. And the most important one is by a man named Robert Solow, who was at MIT, and he published his work in 57. He didn't get the prize until, I think, 82, as I recall. And that's where he demonstrated, and it was accepted in the economics profession, that indeed it isn't capital, it isn't labor, it isn't effort, and it isn't entrepreneurship that is central to the economics. They all count. But the fact is the knowledge that we receive is the core. So in a sense, what this book is an attempt to do is bring together what is sometimes called the economics of reality, or people rather than abstract theory. It's what's going on, what do we know about how things are really created, and what is the role of effort, and what is the role of history, and what is the role of science. Economists, I'm one of them, are famous for having very abstract discussions of distribution of income and distribution of wealth and very abstract mathematical theories. But this is looking at the question of real contribution and real effort. So in a way, we're taking the conservative argument and genuinely asking the question, as it was first formulated by Locke. The second half of the book traces the argument through time and relates it to the knowledge base, the modern knowledge ideas. We're taking an argument that really was launched by Locke in the early part of the 17th century, middle part of the 17th century, that is, that a person should get that which he actually creates and contributes to. Now, in Locke's time, for those of you, I'm not going to do too much philosophy with you, but just for those of you who are into the philosophical part, in Locke's time, he's talking about agriculture. And he says, if you take a hoe and you actually get out there yourself and you dig and you make something and plant it, you have mixed your personal labor with the land and you deserve the product of the land. And it's a reasonable argument about effort. It's also Joe the plumber's argument. He's done something hard, he deserves the effort. That was a time of almost very limited technological knowledge, very limited knowledge in general of how to create economic growth and economic development. What's happened since then, and Locke anticipates it, for those of you who are involved in the philosophical debate, he says if it's 1/100th or 1/1000th of the product, the technology. Labor is 1/100th or 1/1000th. If, in fact, the technology were different, which it obviously is, then the whole equation stops because so much less personal effort is involved in the production and so much more of that which comes from society is involved in production. So, if you put it another way, what we're talking about in this book is reframing the whole discussion of how income ought to be distributed. And there are two ways to think about this. The most simplest way is we're used to being rewarded for what we do, so we think. What we don't really have any broad conception of is how society ought to be rewarded for what it contributes. Now, if society contributes nothing, which is really the idea of Joe the Plumber, and many, many conservative theorists in a more complicated way, if society contributes nothing, then indeed all effort is what one person does. But if you understand and recognize, not only in general, but what the modern studies of the contribution of knowledge show, society in fact contributes most of it, and most of it is by people who are no longer alive that we commonly and collectively inherit. If you recognize that, then the question to Joe is, you get a right to fish in this pond, but you don't get the pond. The pond is created by society. And you might think of taxes then as a license to fish in the pond that was created. Because without the pond of knowledge, very, very little occurs. So that's the broad shape of the argument. I brought you one or two what I thought were interesting quotes to give you, without going on endlessly, just to give you a feel for the way some different people have put it, and then to give you one other piece of it. Here's Bill Gates Sr. Success is a product of having been born in this country, a place where education and research are subsidized, where there's an orderly market, where the private sector reaps enormous benefits from public investment. For someone to assert that he or she has grown wealthy in America without the benefit of substantial public investment is pure hubris. What is it worth to operate within this marvelous system? He tells a wonderful story. I heard him tell this story here some time ago. He loves this story. And this is a very limited view of what we're talking about, and I want you to expand it with me. He tells a story about the two souls are about to be born. And they go to God first, and God said, where do you want to go? He says, if you go to Africa, in the middle of the jungle, you can keep all that you produce. There'll be no inheritance tax and no taxes whatsoever. And you can go to the United States, but when you die, we're going to take it back and give it to the society. What do you want to do? So obviously, there is a great advantage, he points out, to choosing to live in a society which contributes so much to what you can do. That's the narrow end of the point. That's what society currently contributes. If you think about it in a broader sense, without the huge contribution of historically created knowledge, all the way back to the abacus and to literacy, without the alphabet, you can't do much with your computer. And somebody created and massaged that and brought it forward through time so that we could inherit it. It is a very simple but very profound point about the role of knowledge and that which we inherit, and who deserves what in production. Now, let me give you just a couple of objections and interesting questions that come up when you begin to push forward on this sort of thing. There's a second argument that is usually given for why different people people at the top should get all that they get. It isn't simply that they work harder and contribute more. And that's the first argument we're challenging in this book. The second argument is very different, but it comes to the same conclusion. And it is this, that if you didn't reward Bill Gates or somebody else, society would not have the contribution that he has genuinely created. And quite apart from whether he's worked hard, we need the contribution, and therefore it's very important to reward him excessively. And that's a reasonable argument. However, and the book covers this in another chapter that reviews the modern studies of how technology changes, what we've learned, again, is a subsection of the argument I've just given you in broad strokes. The fact is, if Bill Gates hadn't invented the operating system that he invented, somebody else would have. And indeed, somebody else did. There's a big debate about whether or not he took it or modified it slowly. But quite apart from whether he took it legally or illegally, that's really quite a secondary point. What we're learning about how technology progresses and how innovation occurs and how invention occurs is the following. Science and technology and knowledge and studies and experimentation historically reach a certain point in time, and the next step for people in that field pretty much becomes obvious immediately. For people who are working the field, what counts is the flow and development of knowledge, and 10 people see it. Bright people see it, or 15 see it immediately. There's a whole area of studies of invention and technology now. In area after area after area, this is the phenomenon. It occurs in the telephone. Some of you may have seen that Alexander Graham Bell invent the telephone. The answer is 10 people invented the telephone. He got to the patent office first, maybe stole somebody's patent, but that's not even important. The point is that the knowledge base got there, and 10 people got to the patent office. The Congress in 1982, I believe, recognized one of them who, because he didn't have $10 to file his fee, actually got there first. And a man named Mucci, who's an Italian immigrant, Congress recognized him as the first person. But it doesn't much matter. What's important is the flow of knowledge. The discovery of DNA and the organization of that is famous for this, the rush by scientists. When you see scientists rushing to be the first one to capture some scientific breakthrough, some new chemical, some new drug, particularly drugs, what you really have to notice is they know that everybody's on the same track and 10 people are going to be there. So society, and the bottom line is society would in fact have gotten that anyway, because what's happening is the knowledge has been developed to a certain point, and people are in the game understand that. The same is true, of course, DNA I mentioned. Linus Pauling was right on the heels and probably would have gotten there 5 minutes later. In that case, they're example after example after example in the studies of this sort of thing that you get this, the two famous ones. Darwin was frightened to publish his book on evolution because it challenged all the religious theories of the time. So he was holding back and sitting there with the book and not quite sure and, you know, doing what I do and what others do, playing with the margins of the argument. And then he realized that someone else was just on the head of it because he got a letter from somebody, and bam, he published. And if he hadn't done it, three other guys were on the trail. And again, the point is that it's the wave of growing social knowledge that is really the place to look, and that's the place where the action comes. So the bottom line of this is that's why one understands the importance of the argument that, yes, people need to be rewarded, but society would have gotten what they produced anyway, because the real point is the historical development of knowledge. So that reduces one of the objections. The other kind of common objection, then I'll stop talking, we can have some fun talking about the argument, because it may provoke one or two people. The other common objection is that if you begin taxing heavily, you will retard all of this. And here's another place to look at this. The tax rate in the post-war period, in the Eisenhower years, the marginal tax rate at the top was 91%. It's now 35%. The post-war boom years were the greatest period of American economic growth ever. And throughout that period, the tax rates at all levels were far, far higher. Now, for an economist, that wouldn't be adequate information. But there's study after study that demonstrates there are ways to have very significant taxes. One of the most obvious is on inheritance, which doesn't change anyone's incentive. And other taxation studies show that you can do much greater taxation than we commonly now believe we can do historically and in European countries. So let me just say what the book has two different audiences. And one audience is the philosophical community that has been generating ideas about what you can and cannot legitimately and morally claim as a reason for distribution or redistribution. So part of it, there is an appendix addressed to that audience. The other is to people who are considering themselves progressives and care about the matters of inequality and these concentrated distributions of income. And what the argument really is saying, and why it's worth thinking it through, agree or disagree, is that we progressives, I count myself as one who disdains those distributions of income, we have been on the defensive in many ways. People have not challenged Joe the Plumber because they do believe effort is important. But going right at the heart of that argument and accepting it and then saying, but where is the biggest contribution? What is the other part of it? We now have adequate studies to demonstrate that effort is small and important and ought to be rewarded. But that which is contributed historically, above all historical knowledge, that part deserves the lion's share of the reward. And once that is accepted and understood as the reality of the way economic development actually occurs, and the extraordinary contribution and importance of society in the creation of wealth, most importantly in knowledge, then the argument turns. And then instead of being defensive, the argument for distribution really is the argument, how can you justify taking that much, which is our common inheritance, when it is no longer needed to advance economic development? Adequate rewards will do that job. And when it is no longer needed to achieve great breakthroughs, that will happen in the course of development in any case. So the point of the argument politically is that those of us who care about this need to get off the defensive and recognize what the modern studies demonstrate is that we collectively, society as a whole, contributes far, far, far more to any one person's gain and therefore deserves far, far more to distribute in a democratic way and in a more egalitarian way than any of us have allowed ourselves to think. What was really interesting about this whole debate at the end of the presidential debate was how defensive it was. We have not been able to be aggressive on this point. People have been cautious, fearing the idea of redistributing wealth. And the argument here is the wealth is created and to distribute it in the alternative way is a violation of how it was created. So the name of the game in this book, and I hope those of you who have a chance to read it and argue about it, is how do we alter our understanding of what, in fact, is the nature of economic development? What is the nature of who contributes what? And once we grasp that, how it shapes both our moral view of who deserves what and our political view of how we can begin to redress some of the imbalances. Great. Questions, I guess.
I agree with you. This is a deadly serious issue. I'm not sure how you can address this any more than you can the energy problem without talking in a global sense, you know, without relaying borders.
Could you speak into the microphone, please?
Yes. Is that better?
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, just relating to this being as relevant with regard to crossing borders as the energy crisis is.
Well, that's one of the most. Let me reshape that question, if I may. That is really an interesting question because I've been talking about the United States, and that's in a sense a simple case. And he's saying, knowledge. If you follow this argument, what about the world? And the more radical interpretation of the data is that this is a global phenomenon and that the distributional implications are global in their effect. We wanted to take it up to the first step, but one of the ways it's been thought about is as follows. If you accept the argument, which I think is certainly, I think, now well documented, that the knowledge created by society over decades and over millennia is the core of wealth all over the world. Algebra was created long ago by the Arab nation, Arab societies, and the Chinese developed many things. We can go through that. But if knowledge is the core, and if it is a global social inheritance, then it ought to be distributed in some fair way globally. But the practical answer is we have to do it step by step. The philosophical answer, which is one way to think about it, is this. If you imagine a desert, and there is water coming up in a small place, a little bit of water. And that's analogous to the flow of knowledge which creates wealth. And that's, people are dying around. Does the advanced world have the right to capture all the water and let the people die? And if the knowledge is, in fact, the source of wealth, then there is a strong global argument for redistribution. You're absolutely right. A man named Brian Berry has begun to address that argument, but we believed it was right to start at the United States and go step by step.
I'm on your side, first of all. This is a devil's advocate type question. Wouldn't the other side say that, well, yes, I only contributed a little pebble, but all these other people that you want to give my money to, they didn't contribute anything either? And if you say, well, the government represents society, and so the money should go to the government. People will say to you, oh, well, the government never produces anything except paper and bureaucratic red tape. It seems to me an easier way to do it is to say that concentrating wealth in this way slows our economy down, that when more people have more money, real money, not borrowed money, to buy things, then there's a reason for rich people to invest. Otherwise, they just take the capital and they waste it on toxic mortgages and other unproductive investments.
I think I think I hear two arguments. Yes. One is a practical argument about how economic growth occurs.
Yes.
And
the other is what I think people will, the objections that people will make to this argument, that yes, well, I don't deserve to have so much, but neither does anyone else who's living right now. This is all from dead people.
Right. Well, let's take them step. Those are decent, really good questions. The practical argument, I would say, is just wrong.
Okay.
Because I think one of the things that is going on in the current economy is not only the extraordinary craziness in the financial markets and the institutions and the people who've been running them and the rewards.
Mm-hmm.
The rewards in financial markets have been at least double at the top level, double relative to all others. It's an extraordinary tale of not only very, very, very high pay, but also the mistakes they've made. So, but at the core, and then the housing crisis is the part we read most about, but at the core of the economy is the distributional question. That is, and it's an under-consumptionist thesis of those of you who, that is, the distribution of income has been so bad, and I gave you some of the figures, but that means there aren't consumers.
Right.
So you have to loan to the consumers for them to borrow, or the government's got to borrow, because the rich can't consume enough. So just on economic grounds, there's a case for redistribution, and we could have that conversation. On the other grounds, there isn't another choice. That is to say, if the vehicle that represents us all in a democratic society is the government, faulty as it is, there is no other place to allocate. It is the residual claimant, the technical term. The residual claimant of the inheritance is the public authority, the government. If the government is doing a bad job, it's our job to change the government, which we think we've just done in a way. But there is no way around that problem. And then what I think most studies show is that when there is work available, most people want to work. So the creation of work becomes part of the government's job. But I agree that the last 8 years of this government are not a good representation of what a government ought to do. But it's our job, and I think thankfully we did something in that direction, to correct it. So I don't know if that adequately addresses. Yep. Those are the two ways to go at it. Sir?
I think we're on an undertaxed society, and I don't really want to address that. I want to address your issue about effort and received knowledge and whether or not it's the same thing as land, labor, and capital. It's just human capital, the accumulation of human capital, and it's sort of a public good. It's what we inherit. It's what economists call a public good. There's no less knowledge if I learn it than if you learn it.
Right.
But we're not an instinctive species. We have to relearn this at every generation. And whoever learns it puts in some effort to learn it. Mm-hmm. And others don't. Which is why we have distinct distributions of income. The reasons for the maldistribution of income we have in this society in the U.S. are multiple, not just due to people who spend a lot of time with learning knowledge. So what do you say to that argument, that we are not an instinctive species? We have to relearn all the accumulated knowledge, not reinvent it, but relearn it with every generation. And people who put in the effort deserve to be compensated.
Well, I don't disagree with the argument. The issue here is how much should those who put in the effort capture from the flow of historical knowledge, not whether effort should be rewarded. And I do believe effort should be rewarded. But it is important to understand that when there is opportunity, and there have been many studies of this, most people have demonstrably put in the effort. And particularly if you correct for bad upbringing and cultural costs of poverty and the cultures of poverty, there is a normal, most people want to work. So the question is not about whether effort comes, but whether that Gibraltar that we inherit should go to the person who makes an effort and hits a way to capture most of it. So I think we agree on one point, but it's the magnitudes which are very, very, very disproportionate. That's why I wanted to give you those numbers.
I agree with every syllable. But,
thank you.
Tough one.
Yeah. Glad to hear you doing it. Some points. One, wealth after a certain point is power. I mean, you need a certain amount of wealth to live, and then after a point, then it's just manipulative power. That's one issue. The second thing is, if how are we going to go about this? In other words, what is your concept of implementation? And before I hear your answer, I just want to state something. If we're in a world where there's somewhat limited resources or somewhat limitation on the environment to adapt to all our using of the resources, pollution and things like that, might it be helpful to have an overall lifetime wealth tax that basically looks at the amount and accumulation over a lifetime, not just a yearly income, but says to a person, you've had this so much income or so much wealth over your lifetime, therefore we're gonna knock up your tax rate slightly, to account for that? And the other part of the question is, it's a little bit different. Within a culture, there's a class, each generation has a class of very acquisitive people who like power and like stuff and like to get into control. You're going to come up against this with this type of an argument of people who like to lead the General Motors or used to like to lead the General Motors and corporations like that. So there has to be a way of focusing on what are the personality types that get into the upper echelons of any culture and how you deal with that. But I'm very interested in that overall lifetime wealth tax concept. Or what would your implementation be?
Yeah, in the conclusion of the book, we cite different ways of doing it. Overall wealth tax is one, inheritance tax is another, just higher income taxes is a third, taxing the oil companies on windfall profits tax is a fourth, changing the ownership of property. One of the areas that's growing is so-called asset redistribution, worker-owned companies owning the wealth rather than the top guys. There's a whole panoply of different ways of doing it that flow from this framing, not frame. I don't like to use the word framing because it's often been used in a public political way. This philosophical framework, a whole panoply of arguments that flow from it of what way to proceed. On the question of power, which is a deeper question, that is this book flowed out of a trilogy that I've been working on. And the last book was called America Beyond Capitalism, which really is all about institutions, what institutions control money and power. In the framework of this book, what you could say is knowledge, which is the basis of wealth, inherited knowledge, overwhelmingly, not entirely, but it is the basis of exploitation and power, because it allows people to gather power, wealth, but that's derivative of knowledge historically. So that would be one way to get at it, but I'd be delighted to talk about political scenarios at another occasion, and institutional change scenarios, because the power of the institutions is part of it. This particular argument is at attempting to address one of the major philosophical and cultural arguments against this, which is, I deserve what I've worked to get. And that's a central argument throughout the culture, and that's why we took it up in a direct way. Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
Well, Gar, I think a lot of people have said a lot of good things.
This is Patricia Bauman.
Yeah. Assuming we could change the tax structure, gather more revenue from some of the resources that you just cited, it seems to me that one question to ask is, what does the government then do with the resources that it collects? And there, I think you can make an argument, if you're looking at global inequities, that we really want to be serious about green energy, about major global warming, major poverty issues, rather than putting $500 in everybody's pocket to buy more stuff, that we're really, again, cycling back to investments in healthcare, in biomedical research, in education, in the whole realm of things that will continue to generate a societal benefit. So I think as you discuss this, it might be worthwhile to say, and society can take the next step in making a better life, not only domestically, but internationally.
I agree entirely. The argument about redistribution is kind of take the headlight argument, but absolutely, both green investment and global investment of the kind that Patricia is raising, I think is absolutely right on. Thank you, Patricia.
Okay. In essence, what you're saying is that the government should assert its eminent domain over knowledge, and therefore pass along the benefits of it to all the people. And we have that. In healthcare, it's really...
It's an interesting formulation. Did you hear it? Yeah. Or exert its domain, which is eminent.
In healthcare, people are contributing through the tax, I think you alluded to that in the book, who may not be able to have healthcare. They are contributing to the advance of research and to the training of doctors through Medicare taxes, and yet are not able to get it. And what adds to the obscenity is the health insurance companies are making money by depriving us of getting that health care that we have created over the centuries.
Right.
The one question I would have is someone like a novelist like J.K. Rowling, who wrote Harry Potter and made millions of billions. does your argument somewhat fail in that area or not?
Well, I think she should be very I'm proud of what she's done and be taxed very heavily. Sir.
Thank you very much. I'd like to follow up on the question about implementation. I've seen statistics that say that the top 5% of the taxpayers are paying more than 50% of the taxes being collected, something like that. So the implementation question would be, how much more can you ask the top percentage of the taxpayers to pay before you really do reduce the incentive for them to invest the capital that's required? And a couple of short follow-up questions. If we tax inherited wealth, is there a possibility that we will encourage people to spend rather than save that accumulated capital, which might have the opposite effect of what you're trying to gauge? So I'll end up with a quote from Winston Churchill. This might not be exact, but I think you'll understand the concept. He said, "No matter how beautiful the theory, we should occasionally check it against the results."
I'm glad you ended with Churchill, because Churchill, in the early liberal government, liberal governments, the British liberal governments, at the turn of the century, he was a cabinet member. I articulated exactly the argument I'm making without the knowledge argument. He was on my side of the argument for taxation, along with Teddy Roosevelt at the same time. So, yes, but the theory, the current theory, and this is why we quickly moved to implementation. Your questions I'll address. But notice how quickly we moved to implementation questions. And my suggestion for progressives is that we have the philosophical battle to fight, because it always comes down to I earned this rather than society earned it. And if that argument is allowed to slide, when we've let it slide, rather than challenge on the basis of what we now know about the sources of production and wealth, then you lose you may win a couple tactical battles on implementation, but you lose the larger cultural battle, and you find yourself frightened to say something about, well, we ought to spread the wealth around, then you back off. So it's a profound argument that the conservatives, I think, have been right to address at the deeper level, and then come to implementation. And so that's why you know, I spent a lot of my time when we worked together on implementation, and I ran House and Senate staffs, and I did a lot of policy stuff. But I'm convinced we've got to get back to this level, and also institutional power questions. So let me come back to your question. Inherited tax won't do it all. I quite agree with you. So the one part of the book reviews people who have had much higher income taxes along the way, or there are taxes for consumption taxes. There are a whole series of technical ways to try to address one part of your problem in terms of whether you tax now or inheritance or how much you do at the top. I did say, and I'll repeat, that the tax rates of 91% at the margin did not seem to hurt growth rates in the post-war boom era, and we're at 35% now, so there's a real question about this. That's one other way. But the question about how much the top play, what part of the taxes the top pay, I think it's a little less than 55% of the current income tax, not of taxes. The greater part of taxes are not the income taxes. They are Social Security and other taxes, which are highly regressive. You don't get taxed under, it was $100,000, was that the limit? $102,000. And above that, there's no taxation. So people making $1 million are not taxed from $100,000 to $1 million. So when you hear that figure, the one you quoted, ask the share in the total tax burden. Another one is property taxes. Property taxes on your house, and this applies to the people who are losing their houses, the broad middle class, the working class, is on the value of the house, not on your equity. Most people are taxed for what they own. Most people own a very small part of their house, but they are taxed on a $300,000 house. They're taxed on the $300,000. In fact, their equity may be $50,000. It's an extremely regressive tax, and we were worried about the people who fought property taxes in California. But there's a bottom line argument that working people and middle class people were in fact being ruthlessly exploited compared with where the tax burdens throughout the system are played. And if you bring in sales tax, the same thing happens. So when you add it all up, it is true on the income tax that there is a burden. They pay about 55%, but that's a very, but I think it's about a third now of the federal tax burden. Thanks.
Thank you.
Does your book address the role of culture in creating wealth?
It does, but not in a profound way. We refer to some of the studies. In a sense, I'm talking about that, but it's not focused on the cultural production of wealth. No.
I think that's an important issue.
Yeah. It is subsumed, and we do in several places deal with it in passing and refer to some of the studies, but it's subsumed within the larger argument that the creation of knowledge over time by societies, including the cultural creation of knowledge, of course, is what you need to focus on. So we spent more time on various parts of it and referred to the studies of culture in general, but it isn't the central piece of the argument.
Okay, thank you.
Hi.
Thanks. I don't understand economics very well, but from what I can gather, it seems appealing to me.
Economics?
No, your ideas.
Economics is not appealing.
But what I'm concerned about is for a psychologist, like sort of resistance to the idea and just listening to the Republican convention or listening to Fox News or Hannity, that there's like an incredible hysteria about taxes. I mean, they talk about tax more than anything else. I think it's irrational. And I mean, there's a fear, and I've spoken to some business people who are like worried about Obama, and they're, you know, don't see the big picture, very narrow, concrete kind of thinking about, but it's very intense, and I imagine they go nuts with this. Do you have any thoughts of how you would, I'd say, frame or like how you could explain this in a way that people who are hysterical about taxes?
Well, several ways to come at it, but let me reemphasize: this is a strategic argument that if you want to get into this fight. In my view, now it's time for throwing a few decades of your life on the table, which means you've got to go deep. And so the argument is that yes, this is not. This is an argument about how we learn to frame larger ongoing processes. So that's why this book was written rather than the other books I've been writing, which are more political or tactical. Having said that, in a way, I am very sympathetic to people who are worried about taxes, who are working people and middle-class people. And here's why. Because more and more, the security from the public programs, health or from pension funds or declining ability of Social Security to finance your retirement, all of those are getting weaker and weaker. So people are thrown back on their own resources, and they are frightened and need those resources, particularly now, and so it's right for them to worry about taxes. And I'm on the side of progressive increases in taxes, but there's a genuine problem unless the society itself accepts the obligation and then generates a tax program to support it. People are left to fight and struggle on their own, and they're frightened, and reasonably so. That's not unreasonable. Having said that, I was amazed at how easily the argument across, quote, Main Street was to attack those people on Wall Street who are ripping us off. When did you, I mean, it was all, your Marxist textbooks would talk about attacking Wall Street, but this became a conventional argument in the last year, which means that the subculture, the availability and the concern and unhappiness and not quite articulated concern about those way at the top grabbing large chunks is much more available, I suspect, than most of us have acknowledged. So I think at that level, there may be more positive support and positive availability of the argument, of these kinds of arguments.
This will be the last question.
I thank you for your work, and I agree with it. I'd like it to take it to even a higher level, which is that I lived in New York City for 3 years, and through a social fluke of my nephew's prep school collegiate, the people that I moved among socially were these people who are on Wall Street. And I can tell you the average Washingtonian has no idea that these people live behind rather ordinary apartment buildings. They live like kings. Queen Elizabeth would be amazed at the luxury. And I've been to many dinner parties, and I expect, I'm from Washington, I'm naive. You bring up the issue of work, and thank you for your work. I mean, thank God you're here today. But you're conflating work with creativity. I mean, the men would tell me, these are 50-year-old men, not 80-year-old men, they work 2 hours a day. And sir, I'd also, and thank you, bless you for being here, but you're conflating a little bit Linus Pauling, Francis Crick, James Watson, Charles Darwin, who, you know, they did expect to be recompensed. They also expect the praise of their peers. That's huge in the scientific community. You know, if you expect to go to Park Avenue and see a duplex inhabited by Francis Crick, no, those are not the people who live. To my opinion, sir, it's people who chose to go to the right business school, pick the right booze, play on the right golf courses, and a lot of their day is cronyism, and a lot of it is cultivating the right politicians. And again, I want to distinguish between J.K. Rowling, who's a unique case. This woman writes, you know, wonderful books, got paid for her creativity. That's not typical of what's going on in Park Avenue. And even Bill Gates, do I think he's overpaid? Yes, but he did invent, like some, as you say, sir, the people on, and you know this too, sir, the people on Park Avenue are not scientists, they are not inventors, they're not authors. Authors, the best authors can hope for is to live an upper middle class life. So again, don't conflate being a stockbroker with, again, I was appalled to hear one gentleman of 50 tell me he works 2 hours a day.
Good, thank you for your question. I suspect we're close to being on the same side, is that the rewards ought to be changed in different ways for having to do with what society contributes. But thanks for your question. So we're all done? Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Gar Alperovitz podcast. To find articles, interviews, audio, video, and more, go to www.americabeyondcapitalism.com.